Welcome to TV I Say with Ashley Ray, your go-to podcast for discovering what to watch on TV and getting you closer to the TV shows you love. I'm Ashley Ray, a comedian, writer, and former TV critic, and each week my friends, fellow comedians, actors, writers will drop by to dive into the best TV shows we're all talking about right now. All right, let's get into it.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Here you are. BPMs high, sweat dripping, body moving, tongue panting. You're working hard, real hard, and you're thirsty. You need vitamins, nutrients for peak performance and energy.
And your plants do too. Aw, I mean, just look at the little guy. Water-soluble plant food from Miracle-Gro is full of essential nutrients. Just a little scoop into your watering can and boom, instant feeding and bigger, more beautiful plants. It's kind of like a sports drink for your plants. You may have to suffer from heat, but your plants do not.
Beth, thank you so much for doing the show again. There's so much to get into.
I know. It's my pleasure. Nice to see you again.
The first interview was so great. We got into so much. And, you know, I wondered, what are we even going to get with the second season of Natalia Grace? And we got so much. So TV Club, welcome back, Beth Karras. You know Beth as an attorney and TV commentator who worked as a senior reporter with True TV, providing commentary on a number of high-profile cases, as well as legal analysis in the case of Natalia Grace Barnett, or Natalia Grace Manns now, the girl accused of being an adult by her adoptive parents. Part two of this documentary series came out New Year's Day. Beth, where do we start? Where do we even begin with everything revealed in these episodes?
You may recall, Ashley, that after season one aired, it was not long after Michael Barnett's trial had ended with an acquittal.
Right.
So people who had been under a gag order, witnesses for the prosecution, the prosecutor, documents that weren't available for season one became available. So we realized that there's a lot more information than just like a 1 or 2 hour special with Natalia refuting some of the things said by the Barnetts. So it turned into season two. I mean, we had the prosecutor, the lead detective, the guy who's now a sheriff in Tippecanoe County, Indiana, a dentist who had x-rayed.
I thought the dentist was the most sort of bombshell revelation for me because, you know, there's people who still online will say, I think she's still older. I don't know. I don't, but it's also confusing, which I'm just like, are you paying attention? But the dentist just made it so clear that no, the Barnetts knew her age within 5 weeks of going to this dentist. There was no doubt. And even still, as you said, Christine was still saying age inconclusive, but it was, she saw the baby teeth. So that it was just like case closed. What are we even still debating here?
I wasn't kidding when I said in season two that I thought that they may have perpetrated a fraud on the court in Indiana that re-aged her because they did not give that judge all the information they had, nor was Natalia represented. But there was a subsequent hearing a few years later, and a second judge did confirm the re-aging and told Natalia, you're at that point, you know, 27 or something, the judge thought, and you better start acting like an adult. And she still was a minor. So I don't know what was presented at that second hearing. There was a little more information, but it's really odd that an endocrinologist and a dentist both said, no, she's a child in 2010, 2011, like really little, right? Grade school age.
Yeah. And the dentist, I believe, it seems like he wasn't even aware of the re-aging until the documentary process. How can something like that, evidence like that, just be excluded from the court? I think that was a big question that came out, is how are judges able to make these decisions without talking to these people?
The judge in Michael's trial said that he wasn't going to allow the prosecution to relitigate the age issue because a whole bunch of charges dealt with Natalia being abandoned as a child, not just as a dependent person. That's the second set of charges, mirror charges, but one based on her age and one based on her disability. And the judge is like, no, another judge in Indiana, my level judge, has already said that her age is 15 years older than her original birth certificate said. So I'm not going to let you redo that. We're going to dismiss these other charges. If this case had only been based on age, maybe it would have been a different ruling because the case would have been dismissed, right?
Yeah.
But there was a second set of charges based on her disability. So it survived. But yeah, the judge said, no, I'm just not going to allow it. And, you know, there's a rationale for his decision. I don't particularly agree with it because it tied the hands of the prosecution. A lot of their good evidence we see in season two,
yeah,
jurors never saw.
Yeah, it's just so frustrating. I think, you know, as soon as anyone watches the series, their first thought is just, how do we get them into jail? How do we do something? Is it still possible that other charges could come up against the Barnetts?
I don't believe so. I'm not an Indiana attorney, so I can't really give you an opinion about Indiana law, but it looks like the statute of limitations has expired. Plus, Christine's case was dismissed with prejudice. And when a dismissal is with prejudice, that means you can't bring the charges again. So you can have, and sometimes prosecutors want to change some of the original charges before trial. So they'll supersede an indictment. And so the original one gets dismissed. There's no problem. You can, you know, you put a new one in place. But this was a dismissal with prejudice, very significant that she cannot be charged again. Maybe there'll be a civil suit. I understand that Natalia is looking into those options, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
What about some of the new revelations in season two? We find out that Natalia was pepper sprayed. Michael confirms this. So does his son. Is that a type of charge that, you know, doesn't have a statute of limitations, or is it just she's out of luck?
No, I mean, the typical statute of limitations for most felonies is like 5 years. Some states might be a little bit a year or two less or more, but no, that time has lapsed. I mean, she hasn't lived with the Barnett since the summer of 2012, right? So it's been a long time.
Yeah, I think that's another part of the case. People don't understand how long this timeline is, how long this has been going on. It's been almost 10 years. Over 10 years since she, you know, has gone through this process, found a new family, is finally, you know, getting her last name changed, and is at a point in her life, it seems, where she can actually start to think about and come to terms with these things that happened to her. I know a big question people had was, how can we believe she's a reliable narrator? And you provide a lot of perspective on that throughout the documentary. You know, there are people who come in and say, this is common for someone who has experienced this trauma. Or you also, I love the times when you all point out how Michael is definitely not a reliable narrator. But I think for Natalia, people's biggest thing was, well, she was a child. How can we know what she was, you know, that she remembers correctly? Can you address that part of it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, she was prepped for trial to testify at Michael's trial. So when you prep a witness about events from a long time ago, you review things with them. And so, you know, she's testifying about things she knows happened because she was prepped for trial. And there's nothing wrong with preparing a witness for trial and reviewing things, but it makes the memories a little more fresh. So that's one thing, but which I actually didn't talk about in season two, but that is a fact. I don't know about you, but my childhood, I remember in snippets. I remember like my fifth birthday party and I remember a particular Christmas, you know, when I was 10. I mean, I don't remember details, right? I remember certain events in grammar school, but it's very spotty, which Natalia says at the beginning of season two, like a lot of things are vague. And then she proceeds to have very specific memories. Well, I'm not surprised if she remembers a beating or two or the pledge incident or the pepper spray, because this is going to make an impression on that little mind of hers. So it's more like when she's able to recount, like, I don't know, the Ciccone's, her New Hampshire family meeting, Michael and Christine. I mean, Michael's adamant that they never met. And I know people don't think Michael's credible at all and that every word that comes out of his mouth is questionable, but, you know, not everything he said is untruthful. I mean, I'm sure he said some truthful things. He's a very dramatic person. I really don't know what happened at the adoption agency, whether or not the Chaconis, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, whether they met with the Barnetts. They certainly were in contact within a few weeks, and Michael admits that.
Yeah.
But Natalia was 6, going on 7 at the time. It's a monumental moment. I don't know. I call into question some things. Not that there's an intentional misstatement of fact. That's a lie. Just a mistake.
Yeah.
Or somebody just kind of refreshed her memory. So she thinks it's her memory, but it was a recollection. There was I don't want to call it a planted memory, but it's just like.
Yeah. Just
talked about it so much that she thinks she remembers it.
Yeah. And, you know, things get blurry as you get older. But we do have so many examples of Michael lying that it's almost like, you know, why would she need to make these things up? Like the detail about seeing the other family at Disney World and stuff like that. You know, she doesn't really have any sort of benefit. Whereas for Michael, it's like, well, he's clearly being very careful about what he can talk about, what answers he can give. A lot of people questioned, including Michael in this season, that's, you know, supposed to be focused on Natalia. They don't understand why he's given a platform when it's clear he's, you know, overdramatic, he's lying. Like you said, I do think there's a seed of truth in a lot of what he's saying. And a lot of it does end up backing Natalia up, especially like the pepper spray. So I think it is important. How do you feel about him being included? And, you know, the feeling that, you know, is this reliving abuse for Natalia by making him sit one-on-one with him?
Well, I mean, she did not have to agree to that. He wanted the sit down, is my understanding. And I think she felt, you know, she's become very religious. She may have felt that, you know, if they can reach this, you know, she'd forgive him. He'd apologize, that would be good for both of them, which we know does happen at the end. Although some people question Michael's sincerity in that. But
yeah.
I don't question Natalia's sincerity. I think that she really, you know, really does forgive him. I mean, he wasn't the one who was hitting her, although he didn't do anything to stop it, right? So, you know, I mean, Michael is a necessary part of the story, right? Because we don't have Christine. I mean, she's not cooperating. So we have to have the other side, I think. I mean, and it was all Michael, of course, in the first season, and whatever we could get from social media and other sources about Natalia and from records until we could get her. But I think it made for understanding it better to have him there also. And then to have him, you know, say adamantly, I know what I saw. I mean, you're at the end of the bed with a knife. Of course, by the end of all this, people were writing and saying, well, if I was treated like that, I would have been hiding knives too. And I would have been standing at the end of the bed with a knife too. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, after everything she went through, it's at some point it is kind of like, well, when is she acting in self-defense here? And we'll get into sort of where things go with Natalia's story, but I thought one of the sort of just most explosive moments is between Natalia's new father, the Mann's family, I think Andre Mann's, Antoine Mann's, and Michael. And, you know, he's asking Michael not to curse. There's this big blow up, and you kind of see how Michael takes control of the situation, how he, you know, can be very like triggered and reactive to get out of answering certain questions, which is highlighted throughout the documentary. And then, you know, then right after is mirrored with him like giving testimony on, you know, just completely different facts and calmly stating a lie. That to me was one of the just most shocking moments that I was like, oh my gosh, his lawyer couldn't be like, don't do that on TV.
Right. So, I mean, explosive, literally explosive. Well, I thought Natalia was spot on when she said, this is the way he handles things. You know, he just walks away.
Yeah.
You know, he like leaves. He didn't do anything when he was watching Christine disciplining Natalia, abusing Natalia. He did nothing or walked away. He's in denial. So here he just gets up and leaves and drives away. I mean, that's how he deals with conflict. TV, I say.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic Raised Bed and Garden Soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
TV, I say. What else did you feel was a shocking sort of revelation you found working on season two? Was there anything that popped out for you from those, you know, new prosecutor documents?
Yeah, so there, you know, the prosecution released, you know, to the public generally a lot of documents, but then also Natalia gave us some documents and she waived HIPAA so we could use like her medical records. And the two things are the one you first mentioned, that when we first started talking, was the dentist. I mean, the idea that Christine actually signed a form in 2011, this is a year before the re-aging. She signed the form acknowledging that the dentist placed Natalia between 8 and 9. And also about 5 weeks after they got her. So this is like maybe early June 2010. She joins their family April 26, 2010. They brought her to Dr. Riggs. He said she was between like 9 and 11. I mean, he too said she was a child. So they knew from 5 weeks after they got her in their household, her age. And Christine continued to say, I mean, another thing that was really upset me was the teacher and the principal.
Yes.
Who were interviewed, who said she was a great student, she got along with everyone, never caused problems. And Michael believed Christine when Christine said, I get a call every day at 9 o'clock. She's hurting students with her wheelchair. She's banging in her students. Natalia denies it. The principal and teacher back up Natalia. That was revealing too.
Yeah, there were so many instances, I feel, of people giving us a better idea of Natalia's character. In season one, we get some witness statements, I guess, from people who had worked with her in the mental institution she was sent to. And that raised a lot of questions for people. They, you know, didn't understand how she could be saying these sexual things if she was a kid, or, you know, supposedly like hitting on male patients. And the Barnetts were getting calls about this and had to move her because it was so bad. And then we, you know, this season find out, no, it wasn't to that extreme. And it does really seem like a kid acting out when you see the details of she's trying to kiss someone on the lips or she's talking about boyfriends. This clearly isn't a mature grown woman, but someone her age who has probably picked up some bad things.
Yes, but also if there were some sexual things that she did, that's consistent with a child who's been sexually abused. And while we don't know the complete background of Natalia, we don't know what happened to her in Ukraine when she was between the ages of 0 to 4 before the New Hampshire family adopted her. It's not too far out to think that she might have been sexually abused. I mean, that's her behavior is consistent with that. She hadn't really until then been in a good, loving environment. She hadn't learned boundaries. She had an attachment disorder because she's always been abandoned. So there's no question she was troubled as a child. And I believe that she, you know, bit or hit or whatever other children because she's, you know, she needs therapy.
Yeah.
And needed it then.
Absolutely. And she was placed in this environment where she was given no support. I think it really broke my heart hearing Natalia say, you know, at no point did the Barnetts even try to be parents for her. You know, she, you know, Christine was never her mom. And she left these, you know, what seemed like pretty loving relationships with the DePaul family. You know, maybe the Ciccones weren't so great. But it did seem like there's a narrative online of, well, then how come nobody wanted her until the Barnetts? Clearly she was a problem. And we see that's not true. The DePauls loved her. Their daughter loved her. They absolutely believed her age. And it just seems unfortunate that something made it happen where she couldn't be with this family. Do you have any insight into that? I know there's like internet rumors that apparently the Ciccones like asked for tons of money and the DePauls couldn't afford it. And it just kind of was like a legal thing. But why do you think they didn't prioritize at least putting her with a good family?
Diane Ciccone did work for an adoption agency, or I don't know if it's a state agency or what, but I've never spoken with them. They've not cooperated. So I don't have a lot of insight into that. They did feel that she would be better suited in a little people family. And that's why they reached out to the Little People of America, whatever, an organization, and three different families did, you know, look at Natalia. The two families were in season one, the DePauls, or the third family in season two. And, you know, the DePauls were close. It's really unfortunate for Natalia because they were really attached to her, the DePauls, and their daughter, Mackenzie.
Yeah. And I don't think I realized how quickly the Barnett adoption happened. The DePauls let us know that, you know, they didn't even meet Natalia before the adoption went through. They didn't, you know, try to see if she was a fit with their family. Did this not raise any sort of red flags? What?
Yeah, I mean, it does to a lot of people. And even Michael, he said in season one, when they pulled up to Adoption by Shepherd Care in Hollywood, Florida, he was like, we're going to get a child here? Because it was like in a strip mall and a little one-story building.
Yeah.
And it just didn't seem right. And he claims that they said to him, you have 24, 48 hours to come here from Indiana to Florida, or she's going to be put up to foster care. And they didn't want to do that. So they just packed up the family and got on an airplane and went to get a daughter. So it is a little strange.
Yeah. It's so much of this is strange. I guess that's why people seem to have a hard time following the story. And still to this day, wanting to believe Natalia is an adult. I could not stand the neighbor who is featured in season two, who was in the first season, lived with Natalia when she's abandoned in the first apartment building, and is adamant that Natalia was an adult, a menace to their neighborhood, and sexualizing, interactions that she had with, you know, older men and all this stuff. She comes back in season two, is shown footage, evidence, I assume, and still is like, no. They approve she's an adult. She's an adult. No, I don't need to pay attention to this. Why?
Right. Why? And even in the face of the medical evidence to support that she's a child, irrefutable medical evidence to support she's a child, this neighbor, Sue, said, no, it was proven just because a judge re-aged her. But we know how that happened. We know it was one-sided. Natalia wasn't there, and it was the family doctor and a social worker who petitioned, or whose letters to the judge were the basis of his decision.
Yeah. Why do you think people, I know it's a complicated story. There's so many details. It's hard to follow. Why do you think people are so confused by it? And it's created such a, I mean, it's been a cultural firestorm, as the beginning of the documentary shows. You know, people are making YouTube videos that are hours long where they're recounting all the details from the doc to really figure it out. And I'm just like, it's all very clear.
So look, you know, we all like a mystery. We like to figure things out. This is not really a whodunit. It's like, well, what is it? What do we call this? How did this happen? You know, assuming all of this is true, and I think a lot of the abuse has been established. There's no real reliable storyteller here, because there are memory lapses, there may be mistakes, there may be lies. I mean, people are covering their own butts in telling the story. Natalia clearly has behavior problems. I mean, she may have been a victim, but it doesn't mean that some of the allegations against her aren't true. But it doesn't mean she deserved to be abandoned as a child. Yeah. Walking up 16 stairs when she has this disability and a little person living in an apartment not modified for a little person, it doesn't justify any of that. But the truth is, you know, somewhere in between. I'm glad I wasn't a juror in this case, because like if the jurors knew everything we knew, I suspect I know what the outcome would have been. But still, trying to find out what the truth is challenging, because often it's somewhere in between. You know, we've already said it in our discussion. There's like, there are kernels of truth in what Michael's saying. And I'm sure that there are untruths in what Natalia was saying, right? So what makes this fascinating? It was all happening in plain sight, right? This was unfolding in plain. There's a judge who jumped her age from 8 to 22. Like, what? You know, that's in a public court record. Like, how did that happen? As I say in season two, with a stroke of a pen, the judge made her eligible to drink, drive, and vote.
Yeah.
She was 8. And because she was all of a sudden 22, the Barnetts felt, okay, like, she's an adult. she can live on her own. She didn't have life skills. I don't know if you have children, but can you imagine if you do, an 8-year-old living on kids or her own?
I have 8-year-old nieces and nephews. I can't imagine them by themselves in an apartment with a stove and all this stuff. I'd never thought about the fact that she shares that, you know, doctors had trouble treating her. They didn't know whether to put her on a path that an adult would have or something that, you know, would be beneficial as a child. And that has hindered her to this day, where she's had to have all these surgeries and has struggled with her health.
She's in much worse shape today than she would have been if she had the surgeries as a child.
Yeah.
She would have been in better shape.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Capella University is rethinking higher education. With their game-changing FlexPath format, you can earn your degree on your schedule, so you can fit education seamlessly into your life. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
And it's just, there's so much that is still impacting her today that I hope she's able to have a civil suit. I hope she's able to get some additional justice, because every system seems to have failed her.
And her education.
Yeah. So this
She wants to get a GED,
her
right?
GED.
Yeah.
So this will lead into the second part of all of this that I want to get into. We get to the end of the documentary, and it seems like everything makes sense. She's been adopted by her new family, the Manns, who throughout the document have been there supporting her, clearing things up in season one and two. As it seems like we're about to just go to credits on such a happy note, there is the biggest cliffhanger. The Manns family, her parents are on a phone call. They're leaving this message to producers that Natalia is only out for herself, that she is saying that they've treated her like a hostage, that she's lost her mind. And there's more stories. And it seems like, oh no, she hasn't. This wasn't the family that took her in, although it's been 10 years. But I think my question, the first thought I had was, she came to the Manns family when she was about 10 years old. Why over that time did they not support her getting her GED or going back to school if they believed she was a child?
So that's a good question. And I've not posed that to them. I've not talked to them because they don't send me out to Indiana, but or Kentucky, wherever they were living recently.
ID. Send Beth out there. Come on.
So I don't really have an answer for that. Maybe I'm not sure. I don't know if she was working or what she was doing, but she definitely should have been getting a GED when she was, 15, 16, 17, 18, right? I mean,
yeah.
She's 20 years old now and she still doesn't have it. So that is a good question. Also, I mean, she seemed to be in a loving environment, right? We see lots of video of the kids jumping all over her, and the Manses seem to be very tight with her, and she's one of the older children. But that cliffhanger at the end, I mean, my jaw dropped when I saw that too, because, the whole, all six episodes had been finished, locked, delivered, and this happened just weeks before airing.
Before airing, okay.
Yes, just weeks before airing. It just happened last month. All right, so the airing was January 1st. It happened at the time we taped Nancy Grace's show, it happened 2 weeks before, but it happened about three and a half weeks ago.
Okay, because people noticed, I mean, they were like, if you look at the Manses' social media, there's positive, happy posts with her and, some stuff about like, oh, well, maybe she just moved out and is on her own, but she seems to still like her family. And this just blew all of that out of the water. Can you give us any insight into what could have caused this rift between them?
So we're looking into all of it right now. And I don't have a lot of details. Probably if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you, because I think, there's more of the story to tell. But she's okay.
Yeah.
I'll say that. She's okay. And but we're getting to the bottom of what happened. Like, this was supposed to be the one big happy family. I will say, though, that Natalia's grown up, right? I mean, she was grade school and then teenager living with them. And, you know, so maybe her head's in a different place now, right? And maybe she wants a little independence. But I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure we'll be getting into more of the story, though, down the road.
That's the next question. So does this mean probably a season three?
It's not my call, but I think there'll be some follow-up, you know. This won't be the end. There'll be some follow-up.
And again, I felt it was very clear that Natalia was a driving force behind this. She wanted to really tell her story. She hasn't had the chance to share a lot of these details, to, you know, just have a dentist come out and say she was a child. So I think there are people who feel another special or more attention to this is exploitative. But I think this is someone who was silenced by the fact that she was a child when these abuses occurred. She had no ability to speak up.
And then, you know, and the re-aging really messed, you know, I mean, that messed with her ability to, I mean, get the proper medical attention, as you say. And I mean, it was just such an unfair move on the part of the Barnetts. Now, there was somebody, a lot of people wrote to me through my website, when you have dwarfism, you don't lose your baby teeth at the same rate, like at the same time as adults. And she was like, uh-huh. Do your homework. Yeah, you look into this. But and I thought, okay, well, like maybe she could be older with baby teeth, but the DNA test in season two establishes it, right? Nothing to do with the dentist. That DNA test showed she was somewhere within 2 years of
within 2 years. Yeah. And even that is like, okay, if she had baby teeth and was like 2 years older, I guess that could be a little older, but like she still would have been a child.
She would have been 10, not 8.
Yeah.
Right?
10, not 8. And is that, what are you okay with? Like the fact she was left alone at 10 instead of 7? Is that, does that feel okay to you?
So I don't know the answer to the baby teeth if you have dwarfism. I mean, I do need to look into that. But again, it's corroborated by the DNA. So I'm comfortable with how it's all presented.
Yeah. So Christine has shared her thoughts on the documentary on her Facebook, but she hasn't, you know, worked with you guys. Do you think there is a future where she would ever come forward? I mean, if she can't face any sort of repercussions, like, why wouldn't she?
Well, good question. I suppose there's always a chance. It's disappointing because she is a missing link in this whole story. However, it is very convenient, isn't it, that she's just posting her position on Facebook as opposed to sitting down and being interviewed by any of us who can say, well, wait a second. Why did you file this petition with the court in June 2012 to re-age Natalia when you signed the dentist form a year earlier acknowledging that she was 8 or 9 years old? Why are you filing the petition to re-age when the endocrinologist in 2010 told you she was 9, 10, or 11 years old? I mean, there are things to pick apart her story. Michael corroborates the pepper spray. Michael corroborates the beatings. Jacob corroborates the beatings. Remember the hot mic moment
from season. Yeah,
he's like, we're not going to talk about kicking her down the stairs. Natalia doesn't even remember that, right? I mean, she doesn't talk about being kicked down the stairs, but you know. She doesn't remember everything, I guess.
And she does remember, I think she said, Jacob dropping her. And I was like, I could see, you know, as a kid dropping me, kicking me down the stairs. I fell, you know,
So, I mean, there's corroborating. And this whole story about the electric fence and Trader's Creamery, that's what landed Natalia in the hospital. And then the re-aging happened at that month, June 2012. Well, we get a witness from Trader's Creamery, a worker there who's like, the fence wasn't even on that day. And when I got to the scene, the little person was the calm one. It was the mother who was like, she's trying to kill me. It wasn't the scenario that Michael had painted, right?
Oh, yeah.
And presumably Christine saying, you know, she's trying to kill me and arrest her and all that. So,
I also thought it was so just creepy and gross when we find out that Christine had been putting makeup and older clothes on Natalia. And, you know, we have everything with this guy that she had potentially tried to, like, set Natalia up with. It's just all so gross. And then Michael's lawyer steps in. And I have to ask you what you think about this defense attorney. But he steps in and says, no, this was just Christine being a mom and playing with her daughter and enjoying her one daughter and putting makeup on her. And it's like, we're supposed to believe after all of the abuse and pepper spray that she just decided suddenly she wants to, you know, do Natalia's nails. Like,
right. And tell Natalia that she needs to tell people, I'm actually 22. I may look young, but I'm really 22. And I tried to kill my family. Chop her hair off. Bring her to a neighborhood where a white trash neighborhood, as Christine calls it. You know, that's terrible for the people of Lafayette to hear. In Indiana, Tippecanoe County. And she's like basically wanting her to get lost and forgotten. And it was a dangerous neighborhood. Did you hear those gunshots?
The gunshots, while the interviews are happening, there's gunshots. And
some people thought the producers were like, planted it. Trust me, that was not a setup. They were scared and they got out of there.
Yeah, I was like, I don't think they had to set this up. It doesn't look like a great neighborhood. And even in season one, they showed, you know, that it was dangerous. There were people in the area who were doing drugs, selling drugs, and it wasn't a safe place. Not that any place is safe for like an 8-year-old to be alone, but she clearly was struggling here. And it's almost like they put her there as a punishment. Because I've always wondered, you know, it seems like there are institutions, other places that they could have put her, but that would have probably cost more money. You know, we know that Christine would turn off her utilities, that she would be left in the summer without any sort of AC. And it just seemed like another way to abuse her from a distance. So this lawyer, Michael's lawyer, he seems to have every excuse for the Barnetts. You know, they were just, she was a grown woman. He seems to adamantly still believe that Natalia, it was an adult, the way he questions her story and says she needs to take accountability. And it's like, you know, you're talking about someone who was 8 years old at the time. Can you just...
So the one thing, Terrence Kennard, I think he's a good lawyer overall, right? I mean, he's doing his job, right? He's representing Michael, and you know, to the extent he's defending Christine, it's because it probably reflects on Michael. But I mean, he did a good job for Michael, right? Michael was acquitted.
He was acquitted,
and he guided Michael throughout the interviews for season two. You know, Michael is Michael. There's only so much you can control of what comes out of his mouth or how he says things and how he emotes. Because he does emote, right? He's very emotional.
Yes.
And some people felt like he was acting, but
it's very theatrical.
No, but I talked to somebody who worked for him, who's not involved in the production, who told me that's how Michael is. That's how Michael is. That's how he speaks. I mean, that's the kind of, it's just, that's his personality. But Terrence made a good point at one point when he said, like, there's a pattern here. Like, every family that Natalia has lived with has said there's, like, some acting out on Natalia's part. They can't all be lying. That's a good point. But I think what that does show is Natalia, she's having behavior problems. She hadn't been attached to any adults. She didn't know boundaries. And so there might have been problems in the Ciccone household. And, she might have been acting out against the boys at times in the Barnett household. And we heard Genesis Mann's one little girl say, when I was a baby, she bit me.
Yeah.
She didn't know any better. But Natalia was like 10, and she's biting a baby. That's like, that's not a 3-year-old biting a baby the jealous of. That's 10.
What do you make of the hospital report that, you know, Natalia was taken in while with the Manns, and the man said she couldn't come back? They refused to take her calls. And her mother, I forgot it, Christy Manns, I think.
Cynthia
Mann says, so, you know, that wasn't me. That because she was an adult, we couldn't even talk to her. And I think Christine did that, which to me made sense. But I know people have questioned that, especially with the ending.
I don't know what to make of that. I mean, I thought, well, okay, I trusted that Cynthia was telling the truth. And she's like, those weren't my words. That's got to be Christine calling. But how would Christine know?
No,
that she ended
yeah.
up in the hospital. Like, so
and I did wonder if, because Natalia would still have Christine listed as her mom if she was an emergency contact. But at this point, Natalia's, I would assume, has that information changed. But I mean, also she's an adult on paper. So would they even contact her mom?
Correct. Correct. And she had people she's living with. That I can't answer. You got me there, Ashley. I'm sorry. I'm trying to provide as many answers as possible, but I don't know them all. I don't know that we'll ever know all the answers in this case.
Every time it seems like there's more. I think at the end of the day, everyone just wants Natalia to be okay. obviously, this is a story that lends itself to fictional narratives, to movies, to TV shows. I think at some point we're going to see a Natalia Grace show, someone playing her. How do you feel about this story sort of reaching that level and, you know, her kind of wanting a regular life and how it could be a little exploitative to see all of these like fictional portrayals?
Well, if that were to happen, I would hope it would be done with Natalia's blessing, with Natalia benefiting from it in some way, you know, monetarily or whatever, like as a consultant or something, right?
Yeah.
Even though whatever is in the public, she doesn't need to be a part of it. There's enough information in the public domain to do something. But I would hope that she would give it her blessing and be a part of it. This is a story that needed to be told because people need to question how this happened. Like, how did the trial judge allow a jury not to hear anything about the re-aging? How did a judge re-age her 15 years? I mean, yeah. When I was on Nancy Grace after the last episode, I mean, Nancy kept saying, re-age, is that even a word?
Yeah.
Because it's just like, I mean, okay, we understand that people feel like they're a different gender trapped inside the opposite gender body. Okay, that I get that. But you are born on one day in 1 year, right? Like that can't
that's your
change.
Age. I still don't legally understand how someone could be re-aged.
Is
this a thing that's even happened before? Like, are there other stories of this? Where did the Barnetts even get this idea?
It is a thing, apparently, in some international adoptions, if the records aren't like complete or, you know, but it's usually within a few years.
Yeah.
It's like somebody was this like, oh, was no, it wasn't 2005. Gap. It was 2007. You know, it's like within a few years, not 15 years.
15 years. Yeah. So on the case, on the point of people, you know, turning the story into a movie, I have to ask, I know you covered the Mary Kay Letourneau case back in the day. Did you watch May December, the Netflix movie? What did you think about it? You know, that's been a topic over the last week of people saying it was a bit exploitative because it did not, you know, include Vili Folau's family's input or his consultation. How did you think it did at telling the story of this sort of news case that just takes people by storm and takes the media by storm?
I mean, I knew it was a dramatization. So, and you know, I know Mary Kay Letourneau's attorney. I haven't spoken to her about it out in Seattle, but I didn't think that it was all factual. It was sort of, I could recognize, you know, the characters, but they changed enough about it, you know? So, and he wasn't, isn't Vili Filipino. He wasn't Filipino. I mean, and I thought, okay, well, this is sort of loosely based on Mary Kay Letourneau, but I didn't like let myself go there and say they're wrong about this, because that's what a drama does. A drama takes life. It's just based, inspired on, maybe based on the story, but it doesn't mean they have to stay factual to it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's a drama.
Yeah. So. And I think it was a big part of it is making the point of how damaging it can be for the subjects of these crimes when, you know, Hollywood comes knocking and is asking you for consultation and is asking you to drudge up your deepest, darkest, you know, experiences and traumas so they can tell a story. So I think that's a big part of the movie. So I was a little
I didn't know if Vili in real life went through the angst that the man in the movie does. And sitting on the roof with his father his grown son. I'm like, wow, was it really like that? He was almost like his son's age. I mean, there was such there barely age difference, right? And because he was in like sixth grade, right, when his first child was born, something like that. He was like 12. So it was just such an odd. It was so odd that she like fell in love with him when he was in second grade. She knew there was something special about him, and she went to prison for 7 years and had a baby in prison, you know, and then got out and married him. It's like I don't have any contact with Vili. I hope he's doing well. But I just wondered, did he really go through all of that like emotion? I assume he did, but I don't know if it was truthful.
Yeah. And I know people would love to hear his story. And I think, you know, May December had a lot of people reinvestigating, you know, the actual news clips and interviews with them in the documentary. I think, you know, they wrote a book together that was like only released in France that says it tells his side, but obviously was very controlled by her. So I think, you know, sure, there are questions of, is it exploitative to take someone's story and to add your own twist to it and to dramatize it? But I think this is a piece of art that's trying to tell a larger story about what these types of media sensational crimes do to the victims and how we respond to it as a society. And I think Natalia Grace is another one. We're going to see that happen. I wouldn't be shocked.
You're probably right.
I wouldn't be shocked if this movie is announced next week.
If it is exploitative, like, we're all watching it.
Yeah.
So, right? We're still watching it. And they know that.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, I was a kid when this happened. I didn't really remember the story. I think most people my age probably just remember the jokes. They, you know, Mary Kay Letourneau wasn't treated really like a villain, at least in the media I saw. It just seemed like everyone was like, oh, he's so lucky. He's got this teacher and they're in love and they're married and it's fine. And so the documentary or the movie made me look at some documentaries that were like, oh, no, this was a much darker story. There were people who really tried to fight for Billy. And, you know, he tried to commit suicide at like 15. He really did struggle. So I think anything that sort of helps to break down old sort of mythologies that are built through the media is just really helpful these days. And I think it's really great that a lot of modern true crime has taken that stance of, hey, let's re-examine this thing that happened without the you know, all the just like media chit chat and 24-hour news cycle. Let's step away from that and really look at what the facts of this case were. Are there any other cases you think deserve that treatment?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head because I'm sure there are some, but I don't want to take your time at me sitting here silently trying to think. But I'm sure there are. You know, we don't know the truth about some acquittals, some famous acquittals like Casey Anthony, right?
That was one that was coming to mind, and I know Peacock tried to do the Casey Anthony doc from her side, her finally telling her story. What did you think of that doc? Did you watch it?
I actually haven't seen it. I should watch it. I was just so annoyed, you know, the acquittal.
Yeah.
I was done with Casey, but I probably should watch it.
I think that's why most people did it, because it was just like, what do I do to hear from her about? Like, what is she going to say?
Right.
I felt that you see her telling a lot of lies and you see that she really hasn't changed watching it. But I do think that's a case that people are starting to come back to and go, you know, she was the most hated woman in the world. In fact, with Natalia Grace, people were saying, move over Casey Anthony, Christine Bartnett is taking your title.
Oh, that's
which
funny.
Which I gotta say, I don't know that at least Natalia is alive and safe today. So
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Boy, that little Kaylee Anthony, she would have been. She was born in 2005, August 9th, 2005. So, wow.
Yeah.
She'd be 22.
Yeah.
She'd be turning 23 this year. Wow.
So much time passes. It's, what are, I guess, some of the cases that have stuck with you over, you know, your career? You've covered so many.
Well, Scott Peterson was a big one that I covered.
Okay,
right?
That's one people are revisiting.
I know, he's not innocent. Don't worry.
Yeah, I know, like the documentary that came out on A&E, the Truth About Lacey, that one got a lot of people really believing he's innocent. I know that the Scott Peterson conspiracies are huge now. So many people think he needs to get out. I could see that kind of being rewritten in a movie or something.
But A&E had they had his family. You know, that was a project with his family. So. It's from their perspective.
Yeah.
Series.
And
I watched it and I was making a list of all the errors and I was talking to a reporter out in California who had covered the trial also. And he and I were like, you know what? He's keeping his list. I had my list of the errors. And I was talking to one of the investigators who on the case who was making his list of all the errors. And then we're like, we need to do a podcast and just list all these errors.
Yeah, please do it because I mean, I watch a lot of these types of things and I feel like I'm pretty good about like finding the source after being like, okay, what are they trying to tell me? What's the narrative? Who's making this? And that one had me convinced for about a day. I was like, I called my mom and was like, I don't know. I'm starting to think maybe Scott Peterson was in. And she was just like, absolutely not. I lived it. You were a kid. He did it.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. Tell your mom I said thank you. She was setting you straight.
She was like, I watched the court TV. We saw all the evidence. He absolutely did it.
Oh, then she watched me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. She's a huge fan. She absolutely loved that you were on the show before and was so happy you're coming back.
Oh, great. Tell her I said hello. You know, that there was no camera in Scott Peterson, and there was no Twitter, and there was no Facebook. The summer of the trial, what started in the summer of 2004, it ended that December. That summer, Mark Zuckerberg was in Palo Alto. I was living in Palo Alto in a hotel. He was there that summer developing Facebook.
Wow.
And Twitter would come out a year later. So we had Blackberries, and there was there were microphones in the courtroom set up to send audio on speakers into an overflow courtroom in a building across the street from the courthouse. And producers sat in there typing away, basically like transcribing the trial, the testimony. And I had a producer who could type really fast and accurately. And he was sending me basically the transcripts on my BlackBerry. I sat in front of a camera for hours all day. Oh my God, cross-examination just started. First question by Mark Garagos of the witness, you know, lead investigator. Oh, and then question. Answer. And that's how I did the whole trial for months. I sat in front of the camera reading a BlackBerry. Within a year, there was Facebook and Twitter. So,
and it all changed.
You know, it all changed. You never would do a trial like that again.
Yeah, now the people are live tweeting right from the courtrooms.
Correct.
As we saw with like the case of Megan Thee Stallion and Tory Lanez. There were reporters who were able to like build whole profiles just covering the case and tweeting what was happening right away.
But some judges don't let you tweet from the courtroom. I don't know that this judge would have allowed it. They might allow, they allow computers just for note taking, but the overflow room is the one that had to transmit.
Yeah, that's so cool. Just imagine on a BlackBerry reporting live. I know another case people have been revisiting lately and the conspiracies are growing is O.J. Simpson. There's a growing conspiracy that he is innocent and actually his son did it and O.J. covered for him. I was just curious if you have heard of this conspiracy that...
Yeah, I've heard about that. There is somebody who emails me information about that all the time.
They want you to get into it. You got to get to the truth.
Well, first of all, people who think OJ's in. Okay, so OJ was never acquitted, right? Now, an acquittal is not a finding of innocence. It means there is not enough proof beyond a reasonable doubt. You could still have done it, but it wasn't proven. But, you know, and Jason, his son Jason, would share 50% of his DNA would be the same as OJ's, but only 50% of it. What is really compelling is the mixture of blood in his Bronco. There was a mixture of blood. It was Nicole, Ron Goldman, and OJ's. You cannot contaminate and make a mixture like that. Like he left that there. He left that in the Bronco. All right. So, I mean, I will never believe these conspiracies. OJ was really scared in those first days. He had asked his lawyers, like, how long before DNA evidence comes back? That Bronco chase was, I mean, he had money, a disguise. I mean, he had a lot of cash. I mean, he was fleeing, if possible, right?
Yeah.
It seemed like he was fleeing, even though it became a low-speed chase, not a high-speed chase. you know, I mean, I just is what it is. You know, the jury didn't feel like it was proven. Mark Furman, you know, was a proven racist, and that really hurt the prosecution's case. And the rest is history. But, you know, society punished him, right? Because he was not the person he was before Nicole was murdered. He was persona non grata at, you know, the country clubs, and he didn't have the money anymore. And, you know, he lived a much more humble life. I did get to know him a little later in life because I covered his other two trials.
Oh,
He had a road rage trial in Miami and he had his Vegas trial. So I talked to him. I had lunch with him once when I talked to him in both of the cases.
Yeah, I know a bit about the Vegas trial. The judge in that has a daughter who is a comedian and she talks a lot. Yeah, Rachel Wolfson. She talks a lot about that case and her dad being the one to finally send OJ to prison.
Well, her mom sentenced him.
Yeah, I think, it was her mom who finally sent him to prison.
I was in the courtroom for the sentencing. I was in the courtroom for the whole trial. And when she sentenced him, I was shocked at how many years he got for stealing his own stuff, right? Of course, he did it with a gun. He shouldn't have done that. But he gets handcuffed, right? He's like sentenced and handcuffed, makes a statement. And then she goes, get him out of here. Like, get him out of my courtroom. I was like, woo, like she did not like OJ. Yeah. Get him out of my sight.
I had to have you talk on that conspiracy because I feel like just the rise of so many TikTok conspiracy believers has brought back so many of these cases. And it just seems like people, you know, we don't have the same thing now where people are sitting down to watch court TV or true TV and they're seeing like facts. You can really just isolate yourself and watch, you know, all the TikToks you want that are going to convince you OJ is innocent. So thank you for clearing
that's
up.
That's how we get our news today, too, right? I mean, we're really siloed. We choose our news to come from sources that agree with us. So, I mean, that's really interesting. Thank you for telling me all this, because I knew some conspiracies were on the rise. And of course, young people like yourself who were kids or not even born when some of these cases happened are having opinions when they really don't know the facts. Like your mom watched the you know, evidence unfolding in Scott Peterson. So she knows. So you listen to your mother.
Oh, and I have to ask about the biggest one, the Menendez brothers. That one, there's an entire fandom around them that is like, we have to get them out. They're innocent. Like, kids don't believe they did it. That was another case I knew nothing about. I was a kid and I just was like, oh yeah, no, my mom said they did it. They've heard they did it.
So I was an assistant DA at the time. So I wasn't at court TV. I did not see the trials. I was trying my own cases, so I didn't have time to watch a trial. But they never denied killing their parents. They killed their parents. But the question is, were they justified in doing it? They did it.
Yeah.
But did they do it because they were so sick of being abused? And somebody recently has come forward, I understand, an adult, an actor, to say that Menendez, the father, had abused him as a child too. So maybe, you know, the boys are telling the truth and they said their father sexually abused them as kids.
Okay.
And they just kind of snapped.
So Scott Peterson, don't revisit. He did it. OJ did it. The Menendez brothers.
Did it, but were they justified?
But were they justified? There's more there.
It's not really justification because they shot their parents in the back of the head. They weren't facing deadly threat. But is there some sort of diminished responsibility because of the psychological impact of the sexual abuse? Was it really more of a manslaughter or second degree murder, something that they can get out in time as opposed to serving life in prison?
Yeah. So, okay. That one, I'll let the TikTok kids tell me more about it. I'll look into it.
I didn't know we were going to go off on all these tangents. Okay.
I was like, I gotta check in with the expert on all of these other stories that people, you know, like the Natalia case, are going back and forth on the facts. And in this day and age, a fact, even like Natalia was a child, people will refuse to believe. So I really appreciate you coming on the show, clearing this up, talking about season two, and maybe the special we'll get, because that cliffhanger, we all want to know what is going on.
Me too.
Yeah.
So listen, we'll do it again anytime, Ashley. It's a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. Where can people follow you? Do you have anything, like a podcast you want to share?
The latest podcast called Unrestorable, and it's about a mother who killed her two kids, 2 and 3. Their bodies were never found, and she was never ultimately tried for it, though she was charged with murder because she was incompetent to stand trial. So we look in at the intersection of the criminal justice system and mental illness and how the system treats the mentally ill. And what she really meant, she was mentally ill, but was she so ill that she was incompetent to stand trial, or did she game the system, you know? So that's called Unrestorable. And, you know, I'm Beth Karras on Facebook and on X. And I don't know what I am on Instagram and TikTok. I'm not very good with social media, but I'm going to get better. I'm going to get better. I promise.
Yeah. Follow Beth. Listen to the podcast. Get all the news info straight from the source. Don't believe all the TikToks. Let me give you just quickly some TV recommendations. I'm just going to give you one, actually. It is Daughters of the Cult. It is a new Hulu documentary that gets into the Ervil Mormon cult that, you know, a lot of people were killed within. They ended up fleeing to Mexico. It's just all about Ervil LeBaron and his kids. His actual daughters are in it. I think it's 5 episodes on Hulu. I am two episodes in. Usually I finish these for you guys before I recommend, but it's just so good that at two episodes, I'm like, you got to watch this. So we finally have a new cult doc. It's been a while. So that's something to ease you from the Natalia Grace shock. That's your homework. TV Club, thank you so much for listening. Beth, thank you for joining us. And we'll be back next week with another episode.
TV I Say with Ashley Ray. Another episode, another episode.
TV I Say with Ashley Ray is an Earwolf production made by me, Ashley Ray Harris. It's engineered by Abby Aguilar, produced by Anita Flores, executive produced by Amelia Chapelo, and our original theme song is by Rafia. It means so much to me if you go rate, review, subscribe, follow TV I Say. Let us know what you think and tell your friends. Share with your golden girls. Tell your boys. If you love my TV recommendations, let everyone you know know. For special TV Club members, join my Patreon.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.